740 at AM 930 WEOL. Craig, what do you call a touch screen when you touch it and nothing happens?
Broken?
Thank you. Right.
Do I need to call in our crack IT team?
No. Leave them out of the studio here as well. Maybe slip a note under the door and then we run for our lives. Maybe throw some food down or whatever, but stay out of the way. Don't come in while I'm in here. That's my rule for today.
Okay.
Well, this morning we've got a gentleman on the line who's going to talk today about the elements of taste. His name is Benjamin Arrett. He's spent a decade writing, editing the arts pages of Canada's National Post. And in Elements of Taste, he brings together the latest findings from the worlds of psychology, criticism, neuroscience, and market research to examine more about what taste really means and what we can learn about ourselves. Benjamin, good morning. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. Elements of Taste. Craig, I remember Elements of Style that we had that it was all about this. So this book has a lot of sort of science a little bit behind it. But why did you put a book like this together?
Yeah, so I kind of brought some of the science to the culture. I was trying to figure out, you know, there's so much stuff out there now. You know, you can, between Netflix and Spotify and YouTube, you can basically find cultures, that things you've never seen before. You can find your new favorite stand-up comedian just by, you know, going down a rabbit hole, clicking on a link. And, you know, when I was running a new art section of a newspaper, it became clear to me the old rules don't apply. It's really hard to sort of figure out what you like and why.
So how did you kind of figure this out? I mean, everybody seems to have their own taste or opinion. Do those, is taste opinion the same kind of thing? Are they related in any way, or is it? It's just a verbalization.
I think there's some relation. I think taste is more of sort of a cultural thing. It's sort of like, you know, it's not necessarily what you think about politics or issues of the day. It's more like, what do you want to enjoy next? Like, what's the thing? If you're going to go see a movie tonight, if you're going to go out for dinner tonight, if you're going to, you know, whatever song you want to play next, like, that's an issue of taste. And so what I looked at and what I sort of did to that brought something new to this this age-old debate is looking at taste as both a physical thing, like your taste buds, and as a cultural thing. And what I found by sort of going to the research about how we look at genres and what kind of people like what kind of genres is that you can pretty cleanly map cultural taste onto physical taste. So you have sort of sweet culture, sour culture, salty, bitter, and umami. And when you think of things that way, you have a better idea of sort of what you like, and then you can figure out what you're going to like next.
So if we tend to like sweeter-tasting food, what might we like music-wise or maybe movie-wise?
So sweet is sort of the taste of innocence. It's this communal taste. It's lighthearted. It's the taste we all like when we're born. And so it's kind of things that you start liking when you're a kid and that sort of continue throughout your life. Things like romantic comedies or light rock or just comedies in general, sitcoms. It's the sort of stuff that's not terribly challenging, that it makes you laugh, makes you smile. When you hear it, it puts you in a good mood. I think most of our culture is sweet, and there's good reason for that.
Is this something that, as you mature as a person over time, other things get added into it, or do you hold on to some of these and just kind of start opening up your palate, as it were?
Yeah, I think it's very similar to the way we eat different foods as we get older. Like, we start drinking coffee, coffee and beer, things that are bitter by taste. As you get older, when you first taste coffee, you generally spit it out. It tastes horrible. You add lots of sugar and you order a frappuccino. But, the older you get, the more you're willing to drink your coffee generally, with a bit of milk or maybe even black. So, yeah, I sort of see that it goes from sweet to sour, you get salty, and sort of is the taste of sort of later adolescence. Then you get into bitter, and then umami is this sort of interesting fifth taste, which is very sort of cerebral.
You do a lot of, in your book, focusing sort of on music, because that's when we kind of, genres, we think about that. You also have an interesting thing there related to rock and disco. Can you kind of take us through a little bit of that
thought
process?
Yeah, so there was the famous disco riots of the late 70s, when you sort of had this this music that was very much like came out of New York City, basically. It was sort of suddenly on the charts. It was everywhere. People who traditionally liked their classic rock were being sort of challenged by, suddenly Donna Summer was everywhere and there's beats you never heard before. And it was very much like a salty, hedonistic, get out there and dance type of music, and so it was a real clash between the sort of sweet sour of rock in the late 70s and this new salty form. And what I think ultimately has happened is that so much of disco is now in all of the pop music that we listen to. So basically, we ended up adding this salt in. It was a, you know, a bit contentious at first, but now is sort of salt is one of the flavors that is we're just used to in popular music.
Is there a pumpkin spice in our taste anywhere? I mean, is there certain things that kind of come up and take us by surprise, and then we have to figure out how to deal with it, I guess?
That's a good one. Well, you know, of course, the big, not-so-big secret of pumpkin spice is that it's really just sweetness. It's just, oh, here's a new kind of sweetness that we haven't had before. It doesn't actually taste like pumpkin. I don't want to shock any of your listeners. But you have something that comes on, like, I don't know, like this My Little Pony trend, like the new My Little Pony movie is out. Like, this was, popular with my classmates when I was a kid, and now this, my daughter loves it. So it's... these things that can keep coming back, that keep hitting the same notes, and hit those notes so well that a kid today is going to find that just as sweet as a kid in the 80s would have.
What do we learn about ourselves through this, or how can we, I guess, use this to our advantage or make our decisions easier in some sense?
Well, I think, yeah, if you can sort of know your palate, like if you know you like sweet and sour foods, then, you know, it's going to influence how you order at a restaurant. So I think you can do the same thing for culture. If you know you like sweet and sour culture, you can, you know, what movies you're going to like. You can think, well, I want to see a thrilling movie, but I also don't want it to be, you know, too salty, too dark. So I may not like the Christopher Nolan Batmans, where every scene is basically raining and dark in a gritty city. I might be more in the Marvel movies where, you know, it's... there's action, but it's brightly colored and funny and, you know, sort of lighthearted. So basically, my pitch is if you buy this book, you'll have a better idea of what you like and what you're going to like next. It'll help you if you have to figure out someone else's taste out, to buy them a gift, you know, you can figure out what they like. And if all else fails, you can just give them my book as a gift.
That'll work there as well. How do we bring people over to our taste, or is that a futile attempt to do something like that? We have to give it in small doses?
I think it's a bit futile. I mean, you can figure out what they like. If they are, they like, let's say, bitter. You like, if they're just sort of sweet, so they sort of stick with sweet culture, and you want to try to give them something a little more bitter, then you go sort of give them something that's sort of bittersweet. That's, a chart-topping pop song that has sort of more depth to it and is about more interesting things than they might... know, tell them the stories behind the songs that they love. Because, of course, behind the music, there's so much stuff that goes into so many of these songs. And when you hear that, you realize this is not just something, this is actually a piece of art that someone put their heart and soul into, and there's a lot of interesting ideas in it. And then once you go there, then you can sort of, go on from there and sort of look at other, if you like that, you might also like this, and you sort of keep going.
The like this, like that reminds me of the whole things on Amazon and those other places where you're clicking on something and suddenly it says people that like this also like these particular things. Are those really kind of accurate, or is that sort of just a sales pitch? Do you see a similarity to what you're talking about and how those algorithms, I guess, are put together?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they have a lot of very, very smart people and very smart computers working on those, and they can do all sorts of, I talk about how the filters work and how they sort of figure out what people who like the things you like also like, and I think there's obviously a lot of validity to that, but at the same time, I think, we can think about this problem too. I think it's just as easy for you to figure out, what do I actually like? I'm not going to let a computer do all the work. I want to figure out what I like, and also... if I want to surprise myself, if I want to stretch myself a little bit, try something new, one of the problems with these filters or these algorithms is they're never going to recommend something that you've never looked at or never thought of before. It's very hard to – you get stuck in your ways if you sort of just allow the computer to tell you what you're going to like next.
Right. I've discovered this in a sense, and I'm from a generation where we were sort of forced to either watch what was on our television. We didn't have a choice to determine. So you'd end up being exposed to classic movies or things that are black and white or something that, that long since passed. Or you're at a bookstore or you're going through books and you kind of come across one and a cover catches your eye, where you're exploring things that you didn't know you could find. So you're not being filtered. Is that a problem we're dealing with a lot today?
I think so. I mean, you see that in news, you see the filter bubbles. I mean, I look at it from a cultural point of view, but I just think no kid loves film noir, you know? But if you really get into it, you can absolutely love it. And it's that first exposure that you sort of have to do for yourself. No one's figured out a good way to do it for you yet.
Again, the book is called Elements of Taste, Understanding What We Like and Why. Benjamin Arrett, our guest this morning. Ben, thanks for your time this morning. Appreciate it.